Spirit Catholic Radio, KVSS. We are Catholic Radio for the Christian community. Good morning. Welcome to Spirit Mornings with Bruce McGregor and
Chris McGregor.
And Chris, this morning we are joined by Carl Summer. He holds a master's degree in historical theology, lives in St. Louis, Missouri, and has a lovely wife and a couple of children, and has written a wonderful book here called We Look for a Kingdom, The Everyday Lives of the Early Christians. And Carl, good morning. Welcome to the program. We're delighted to have you with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you as well.
And we want to give you the opportunity to say hi to some people that you might know here in Omaha.
Yes, I'd like to say hi to some classmates of mine from Conception Seminary from 1983 to 1985. I may forget a few names, but the names that ring out in my mind right now are Mark Phillips and Al Salinitro. And I know that Al is now a Father Salinitro, a priest in your diocese, and I'm sure that he's doing an excellent job.
Yes, Father Salinitro is now the pastor at St. Bernadette's Parish here in Omaha, and much beloved by the McGregors personally, as well as Father Carl Salinitro. So it is so good to have a connection like that.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And I'm sure that there's a very vibrant Catholic community in Omaha, and I'm excited to be with you today.
I'm excited to be talking to you about We Look for a Kingdom, The Everyday Lives of the Early Christians. When I first saw it, of course, this is published by Ignatius Press, which has such a solid reputation. But when I saw it, it was kind of big, and I thought, okay, this is going to be very deep. And while it is true, it's a thick book, and it does contain a great deal of information, it is a wonderful read.
Mm-hmm. Well, that pleases me very much. I intended this book to be for as large an audience as I could possibly get for it, simply because I believe that the early church provides a model for the life of the church today. The way that they dealt with the difficult culture that they dealt with can provide a model for us today. And so I wanted to try to introduce as many people as possible to the early Christians.
I think you've done a beautiful job of it, and I think it is so necessary right now to have the approach that you've taken, because I'm sure you've seen, Carl, especially on television and in popular books by certain people, shall I say, Elaine Pagels and Bart Ehrman and everything, they're trying to almost dissect, like the church is some kind of cadaver that can be just dismantled and then never put back together again.
That is correct. I've read their works, and I have to say that there's an awful lot of speculation in the kind of work they do, and not a whole lot of solid evidence to back it up. That's why I went back to the primary sources. I quote them extensively. Clement of Rome, Clement of Alexandria, and Cyprian of Carthage, Ignatius of Antioch. And if you read the writings of these authors, it's very difficult to come to any conclusion except that what you had in the first three centuries was the beginning of the Catholic Church, the church that we belong to today.
You point out very early in the introduction something that is very, very true. Why do we read history? And I think it is because basically we love a good story. And the way that you present this, it is first and foremost a wonderful telling of the Christian story.
Thank you. Well, I think the story tells itself.
Yeah.
You know, the circumstances they found themselves in, you know, founding a church. Well, Christ is the founder, of course, but they had to set the tradition properly in the first few centuries. Founding a church in that culture where they were persecuted, and when not persecuted, ridiculed, where there was such a disrespect for human life, which is something that the church attempted to foster in those early years, it was an extremely difficult task for them, and as you can see, they passed the test.
Mm-hmm.
They did well.
I find it amazing that in today's scholarship, that there would be writings that had been deemed heretical or unreliable by Orthodox Christians, even in the day that they were written, would be lifted up as authoritative, as opposed to the writings of the early fathers, which you rely upon heavily, that is not lifted up as the authority that we should be basing a lot of our opinions on.
If I may, I hesitate to speak ill of other scholars, so I just want to speak in general terms, but
sure.
The scholars who do so are operating on a 100-year-old theory that holds that each document of the early church, whether it was in the New Testament or otherwise, that each one of these documents had a community behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So when they read the heretical gospels, the documents that were found at Nag Hammadi, for example, they believe that there was a community behind each one of these gospels that believed what is in those gospels. And I think mm-hmm. that might be an erroneous assumption on their part.
Mm-hmm.
Undoubtedly, there were heretics in the early church, just as there are today. But there's no evidence that there were large communities of people who believed the things that are found in these documents.
I think the way that the book is set up, we look for a kingdom, the everyday lives of the early Christians, you really help put us in place. I love how you start out with what life was like in Rome, what the average Roman would have encountered.
Yes, I enjoyed putting that together simply because it's one of my great loves is history, especially ancient history. The further back you go, the more I like it, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just fascinating, the remarkable similarities between life in the first century and life today and the remarkable differences. They were much more attuned to actual violence
mm-hmm.
and actual bloodshed in a way that we find it hard to imagine. You know, we watch violent movies, and there's always a quality of unreality about it. But when you went to the arena and saw someone die in the arena, there could be no doubt what was happening right in front of you. And that tended to harden people to violence in a way that we perhaps can't really understand today.
Mm-hmm.
And that, by the way, is what made it so easy for them to persecute the Christians in such horrendous ways. They were so used to violence that they didn't see anything wrong with the forms of death that they meted out.
Yeah, it really is something. And again, the parallel with that period in today's time, when you were talking, I was thinking of the violence that comes into our homes, that the Romans, they might have gone to the Colosseum and actually seen blood sport firsthand. And yet we expose ourselves and our children that every day, television, the internet, on all different various forms of media that the Romans never really anticipated.
That is correct. And it would seem that we're coarsening ourselves as time goes on. We desensitize ourselves to a certain level of violence, and then the media ups the ante, and we go to another level with it. And, of course, that ends up leading to, in my opinion, horrible incidents like what happened recently at Virginia Tech, where
mm-hmm.
someone decides to actually act out that kind of violence in a tragic way.
Yeah, and it is very, very hard to be exposed to all this too, Carl, because beyond the ordinary media, then you have Hollywood that is really putting forward all of these really awful slasher movies and all this other stuff. And it almost does end up taking on that same type of gore as it did in early Rome. I mean, little is left to the imagination.
That is correct. That is correct, yes.
I think that's the wonderfully valid reason why someone would want to pick up We Look for a Kingdom, the Everyday Lives of the Early Christians, because how you present that, it also makes it seem as though what those Christians encountered and what we encounter today, we can draw strength from, but also it's so foundational to who we are as a Christian people.
That is correct. Respect for human life was inculcated at the very foundation of Christianity by Jesus himself, and they were encountered with a culture that did not respect human life,
mm-hmm.
just as sadly we are as well.
Yeah, and I love the section on what it was like to be a Christian at that time, and just some of the beauty of the ritual that they have and how it developed that our church today is trying to recapture through the rites of a Christian initiation and for adults and a number of other things. By looking at the history, that makes even more sense now, the rites that we do today.
Yeah, I enjoyed writing the chapter on initiation possibly more than any other chapter, because I do RCIA myself. I could see the parallels, and I could share those parallels with my class, and it helped them to understand the things that they were going through.
I think that's where it really comes alive. And again, this is no dry read. It's just fascinating. I have to ask you, I mean, this is your first book, isn't it?
That is correct. This is my first book.
You're going to have to write a lot more, you know.
You
can't have a gift like this.
I have other books in the works.
Thank goodness, because you can't have a gift to be able to articulate this in such a captivating way and not be able to share it. Because just the stories, pulling together the writings of Hippolytus. But, I mean, so many of the other church doctors and the fathers of the church, in making it all coherent. I mean, there is the wonderful volumes. I'm not sure how many volumes in the whole set on the writings of the church fathers, but that can be intimidating for some folks to see all that.
The anti-Nicene fathers, the fathers before the Council of Nicaea, cover like 38 volumes.
Is that all?
I'm fortunate I have it on CD-ROM, which makes it easy for me to search and find what I'm looking for. But that would be virtually impossible for the average person to wade through, that's for sure.
But yet you've whetted our appetites, because you've given us a perspective on when they were writing, the pertinence of their information, how it backs up church teaching. So this isn't something that was just pulled out of the air a few hundred years after the life of Christ. You've shown the continuity in teaching.
Yes. Some points actually even surprised me. When I read Clement of Alexandria talking about birth control, for instance, it surprised me, because I fully accept, of course, the Church's teachings on birth control, but to hear it articulated by someone so early, you know, we're talking about around the year 200 A.D., to hear someone articulate it so early was a little bit surprising and quite inspiring to me.
Oh, yes. From what I understand, even in ancient Rome, the abortion rate was outrageously high.
That is correct. They knew of they had two means of procuring abortions. They knew of certain herbs that would cause an abortion, and they also, unfortunately, also tried the method of using a perforating, placing a sharp object into the womb, which that method was not used very often because, as you know, it would have an extremely high death rate for the mother as well.
I have to thank you, because I think if only by itself, your chapter on the organization of the early church, I think that's extraordinarily helpful right now, giving everybody, just the average person, the perspective of how we came about the individual roles and leadership, and how it's a natural, logical flow from that appointment of the 12.
That is correct. It's an organic development as opposed to a development that was imposed from the outside. And that's what we mean when we talk about apostolic succession, and, you know, the fact that the bishops today have the same authority that was granted to the very first leaders of the church.
It's difficult, I think, for them to understand how our individual roles and that selection by Christ of the 12 led to other leadership positions. And it flows from that. I think that's what happens when we get caught up in discussions about women priesthood, for example, that somehow that because a protesting church, otherwise known as a Protestant church, would lift these elements up, what they're doing isn't connected to what the tradition of the church has always been.
That is correct. And I've seen several books recently that have tried to present the argument that the early church did indeed ordain women. The evidence is flimsy at best, non-existent. It would be the most likely, the most reasonable term to use. The early church simply did not allow women to preside at the Eucharist. There were women in various ecclesiastical positions in the early church. There were, in the Eastern Church, there were deaconesses. Widows played a prominent role, and the term widow was used technically as someone that had a role within the church. And the role of the widows was to quite simply take care of other widows who were less capable of taking care of themselves. There were consecrated virgins in the early church. We find that very early on. We find Clement of Rome in the 90s already writing to advise a group of people who had taken vows of virginity. So there were many roles for women in the early church. The one role that has always been withheld from women, for reasons we do not understand and possibly never will, was the role of supreme leadership and presiding over the Eucharist.
The fact that it was a position that was instituted by Christ.
That is correct.
Is not something that we can go back and just, well, we didn't like the way he did that, or that if he were today, we presume to know his mind so that we can go back and change it somehow.
We would have to, I think we should trust that he's smarter than we are.
Yeah, I think I can do that. That's a good idea.
Good point.
And there are always reasons beyond what human reason can grasp. And we should also bear that in mind, that there are reasons for things that we're not quite capable of grasping, and sometimes we just have to trust them on faith. But Jesus called the 12. The 12 set up this thing we refer to as apostolic succession, and it was, from the very beginning, a male institution. And having said that, there were numerous roles for women in the early church, and there are numerous roles for women in the church today.
The fact that he chose to be born of woman, and that the woman that he had chosen was the Blessed Virgin Mary, and her guidance and her role, a modeling for all of us females in that nurturing. I think there's so much to explore that it's not just about who's a leader, but about what God has created us to be and our role in salvation.
That is correct.
I think it was very compelling in the book where, I'm going to quote this, there is a book on the early church written in 1990 with the very first chapter titled, "The Wonderful Time When There Was Neither Clergy Nor Laity." And I know you're not bashing other scholars or anything, but I think it's indicative of the confusion that has occurred in the church because of our lack of a knowledge or appreciation of our history.
That, you know, that is correct, but if people would only reflect for just a second, they would see that from the very beginning, that was not the case. You know, we read in the New Testament that Jesus had hundreds of followers, yet he chose the 12 for a special function. That already establishes a distinction among people. You know, not a difference in worth, not a difference in basic human dignity, but a difference in role.
Right.
And so there really never was a time when there was no clergy or laity. The terms, by the way, are used very early. The term clericos refers to a key. I'm sorry. Let's go back and start over on this one, if we could.
Sure. No problem.
Right ahead.
The term clericos refers to an inheritance or something that is given to someone. So the clergy were seen as heirs, if you will, of the ministry of Christ. The term laicos refers to simply being of the people. The word laos in Greek means people. So laicos means of the people. So the distinction that was made is we're already finding it in the letter of Clement of Rome, his first letter to the Corinthians, written most likely in 96 AD. So even though these terms are not specifically used in the New Testament, you know, in the generation immediately after the New Testament, they're already in use.
Absolutely. And understanding that continuity and that connection is so vital to how we understand our faith and trust in it, and that whole tradition. But again, you know, we look for a kingdom, the everyday lives of early Christians. Frankly, I think this is an outstanding book for adult faith formation. If groups were to take and just study each chapter and then have discussions on it, especially as you get into the chapters on how the early Christian lived out his life on issues such as slavery or Christians and the military, so many different issues and how they lived out their life, it can be a reflection on how we live out ours.
That is exactly the way I intended it.
Good.
That is exactly the purpose for which it was written. Because these issues never leave us. There's something eternal about the human condition, and so the same issues and problems keep coming up again and again.
Yeah.
And they did such an excellent job of shaping and guiding and transforming their culture that perhaps if we followed their model, we could do the same thing today.
And the section on the early Christians and family life and what the model was for the Christian family, I just thought it was just outstanding.
Being a father myself, I enjoyed writing that chapter, I must say.
It is. It's something that everything, we kind of touched upon abortion, but also about marriage and divorce.
Mm-hmm.
Again, what's old is new again.
I would like to emphasize that the early Christians took Christ's prohibition against divorce to be absolute.
Mm-hmm.
They did not read into it the nuances that people read into it today. Yeah. You'll find in the Shepherd of Hermas,
mm-hmm,
a document written approximately 150 A.D., you will find a pastoral recommendation that if a person's spouse is committing adultery and they are unrepentant, that you should put them aside but not remarry.
Mm-hmm.
And then if your spouse is repentant, comes back to you and asks for forgiveness, you should take them back. But there's no sense that even adultery or other things like that are grounds for divorce. If you're married, you should stay married.
Well, you can ask the guy I'm married to. How about this, Bruce?
Hi.
This book has been sitting next to the bedstand, and every night I go back and I read a chapter a night. Because you can sit and just ponder and just kind of digest and chew on each one. And as you come away from it, you really feel, you get a sense of that time of the early church.
Well, I'm glad if you've had that experience reading it. That gratifies me a great deal.
I also like the section that you have in the book that covers just famous people, essentially, notable figures in early Christianity, a lot of names we might have seen or heard. And you've just given us a little snippet so that maybe if we want, we can pursue it to go a little deeper.
Yeah, I found that, you know, I was presenting authors and fathers of the church without much context, because it was a topical study rather than a chronological study, and so I believed that I needed to put some information in there about each one so that people would have something to hang their hat on, you know, when they lived, what their major issues were at the time.
Well, there's so much content to this book, but there's nothing dry about it.
No, great read.
And your style of writing, it again evokes you'd be hard-pressed not to see the parallels in today's world, and I think that's why it's so vital. It's not just a history book, but it calls upon you to reflect on what's going on right now.
Well, I never wanted to write a dry book, so I'm glad that...
You succeeded.
...get interested.
It's not dry. It's wonderful.
We've been delighted to be having a conversation today with Carl Sommer, author of the book, We Look for a Kingdom, The Early Lives of Everyday Christians. Carl, before we wrap up, anything we missed or any postscript you'd like to put on the interview?
I'm very glad to be with you. It's been a pleasure to speak with you. Maybe someday we'll see each other in person.
I hope so, too. And I have a feeling if you're open to it, we'll be talking to you again, because I think your depth of knowledge on this can be beneficial and you can teach us all, just like you do your RCIA class.
I'd enjoy that very much.
All right, Carl Sommer, thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank both of you.